The Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.
Hi, and welcome to the Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast. And in today's interview, I've got a chap who I've admired for quite some time by the name of Dan Bradbury. And Dan's been on my radar for quite some time because he helps coaches start and continue to grow their coaching business. That's really interesting for me. But also, and I wasn't aware of this at the time, but he actually buys businesses for quite a small amount and then adds value to them, turns them around, and then helps them generate a lot of income and then sells them for more money, which I think is really interesting. So Dan, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So I've known you for quite some time on the circuit, on the public speaking circuit. I'd say about 4 or 5 years, actually. And the first time I came across you was when you were helping other small business owners. And that was me, really, a couple of years back on my coaching business. But you helped coaches get their business off the ground. I'd like to know a little bit more about why you wanted to do that and some of the success stories that you've had from that.
Sure. It was really quite simple. I decided to do that because I had a lot of pain. Specifically, I've always been interested in kind of learning developments, always kind of been learning new skills and things. And my first business, Dan, was a speed reading business. And I'd learned how to speed read, and I'd got so proficient at it, I actually entered the speed reading world championships, which isn't awesome. It isn't quite as glamorous as it sounds. The first year I came sixth, and the second year I came third. I got the bronze medal.
So, that's amazing.
So I could read incredibly fast, but I'd also learned how to teach that to children. So I developed a business where you could give me any child, Daniel, any child, even if they were dyslexic, etc., and I could rapidly increase their reading speed with improved level of comprehension with just a few hours, like an afternoon.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So we used to take classrooms of children, and we would get them to do like a test before, then do all the practice and do another test afterwards to test their speed and comprehension. And the results were just dramatic. So I wanted to really expand this into a business and take it worldwide, internationally. And I remember actually one time I got a series of good fortune, I got a speaking gig in the United States talking about this topic. And when I kind of presented on it, Les Brown, the kind of, he's not as well known in the UK, but he's a well-known international motivational speaker, yeah, came up to me, shook my hand and looked me in the eye and said, "Dan, I'm going to make you a millionaire." And I was, you know, 19, 20 years old at the time, full of dreams and ambition. It's exactly what I wanted to hear. Yeah. But lo and behold, just one short year later, I was absolutely up to my eyeballs in personal debt. I had over £109,000 worth of personal debt, Dan.
Wow.
And I was clueless. And basically, I ended up defaulting on all my loans, credit cards, etc. And I didn't decide to go bankrupt, but I probably should have done in many respects. And that's when I kind of realized, Dan, I thought the problem was a lack of money. That wasn't the problem. That was the symptom, the root cause. The root cause was I didn't have a system to generate clients, to attract clients and make money. So that was what was causing me to not have this money in my life. So, you know, literally, I could have won £100,000 or whatever, or £200,000 on a scratch card. Give me enough months and I would have been back in exactly the same position because I didn't know how to generate money. And that's what made me decide that despite having all these skills that could really help somebody, I was unable to monetize it because I didn't know how to sell and market myself properly. And that's what made me decide to want to help other coaches.
Do you know, so interesting when you say that having no money is a symptom rather than a cause, because people say, well, if I only had more money, then I'd be able to do this, this and this. But my belief system is that if you can't look after the money that you have, then the universe will not give you more money because you're not capable of looking after it. And so some of that becomes into systems, like you mentioned systems for marketing, for example, but also systems as in looking after your money that you're spending each month as well. Because most people haven't got a system for that. They keep spending until the money doesn't come out of the machine anymore, you know?
Right.
But I find it so interesting that you say not having money is a symptom not a cause. Because so often, and I'm sure you've heard this as well, where are you living in cause or are you living in effect? So some people live in effect, as in the world happens to them and the reason they have no money, well, this went wrong and that went wrong and that went wrong, and therefore it's not their fault. Whereas, and this was my shift as well financially, because I've been there with debt too, and I think it's like a badge of honour for most entrepreneurs, one way or another, not having any money to begin with. But then as soon as I shifted over to living at cause, well, I'm responsible for what happens to me, and I made the decision to go out and learn marketing, which is, by the sounds of it, exactly what you took as your next step.
Yeah, no, it's precisely the next step. Just one point before I kind of move on to that next step is, I just think about it logically, Dan, for every effect, there must be a cause or causes. So if the effect is missing, so must the cause.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've got the effect called no money, then you must be doing something that's creating no money.
Yeah.
Or rather, a better way of thinking about it is think about it as the process, not the destination. If you've got the effect called every single month you run out of money before the end of the month.
Yeah.
Then that's because you've got causes that are creating that. And I believe that there are five kind of key causes that create the effect called sales in a business, for instance. But that's going off on a bit of a tangent. But if you nail the causes, the effect will take care of itself. You know, again, to be overly simplistic, Dan, I can look in the mirror, or a lot of people who are listening to this can look in the mirror and go, I want to lose weight. But it doesn't matter how much you look in the mirror, you're not going to lose weight. The weight you are is the effect of a series of causes. Two of those causes that you have control over is what you eat and how much you eat and how often you exercise. Yeah. And how you exercise. So if you change those causes, you'll change the effect called how much you weigh.
Yeah.
It's science. You can't get away from it. So yeah, what happened next to me was I recognized that the problem was that I didn't know how to attract clients to make money. So I decided to do the only thing you can do, Dan, when you're up to your eyeballs in debt and your business is failing and you're a real man. The only thing that you can do, I ran away.
Awesome. I've been there as well.
Yeah. So, you know, I kind of buried my head in the sand, and what it allowed me to do is I took a job working in sales. Now, I'd already proven that I couldn't sell myself. I didn't know how to sell. I'm not the same Dan as is speaking to you today, where I've been reasonably proficient at learning how to sell and market myself. But I took a job in sales, not because I wanted a sales job, but because it was working for an NLP training company and I wanted to get NLP training and I couldn't afford to pay for it.
Yeah.
And I also did recognize that through the concept of modeling that if I surrounded myself by people who could sell, then perhaps I could figure out how to do it. And that was one of the causes that I needed to get in order to create this effect called more money in my life. You know, Dan, I believe that a lot of people, when I had all this debt, all the people around me, my peer group, my family, my father, etc., their response was, right, you need to cut your expenses and live within means. And I think that's valid advice. But I kind of was like, I was making almost no money at the time, Dan. I, at that point in my life, the maximum I had ever made was about £1,200 in a month.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I've got £100,000 worth of debt, I'd have to cut my expenses down to zero for an awful long time to pay that debt off.
Yeah, it's just, what, about 8 years, isn't it?
Sure. And I also, I kind of couldn't help but think, right, okay, I can do that, but I've got no lifestyle. Even if I had no debt, I've still only got £1,200 a month to live on. And so I started thinking to myself, well, what lifestyle do I want? Well, that lifestyle is going to necessitate me earning a lot more money. So therefore, the only logical conclusion I could see was if I could figure out how to make enough money to pay this debt off in 12 months, Dan, I thought, no, once I paid the debt off, as long as I live within my means as well, I would then be able to create the lifestyle that I wanted for myself at that stage.
So context is really important, you see, because most people go, well, I've got 30 grand's worth of debt and that's my problem. And that's not the problem. The problem is that you're earning 15 grand a year. Whereas if you're earning 200 grand a year, suddenly it's not a problem. And when we change the shift of our focus and the context then changes, and it comes from asking a better question, doesn't it? Which is what you've just sort of edged towards there about, well, for me to have this lifestyle, I need to earn a lot more money. And then, so you started asking yourself a better question, which was, well, how do I go out and earn that money? I'm guessing that's about on track, is it?
Right, that's it. That's exactly right. And in the short term, I actually went further upstream and said, well, I need to learn the skills to allow me to do that. And I recognized the problem wasn't the product. I had tremendous value to add to people in the speed reading context, but I didn't know how to market and sell that value. So I said, how do I learn that skill? So I went and took the job in sales so I could learn how to sell other people's programs, NLP trainings that I believed in at the time, that I thought were good, that I thought would really help people. And I learned how to sell those products, but I learned how to sell, in effect, any product that would really add value to people's lives. And then after working there for a period of time, I moved from sales into marketing for that company. So I was given a budget of 30 grand a month, and my job was to put 1,500 people a month, get them booked onto introductory seminars for this NLP stuff. And that was interesting and insightful, and I learned a lot of skills. And then from having mastered these skills, I recognized that I could add a lot of value to business owners, or in the early days, it was other coaches, by teaching them how to market themselves more effectively.
Yeah. Interesting as well, the problem is never, well, not very often, the problem is unusually the product. It's always to do with the actual sales process, the mechanism by which you sell the product. And then from a positioning point of view as well, usually, the problem isn't the product, it's the belief system of the person selling the product. So, and interestingly as well, for me, when I first started coaching, I really struggled selling my own coaching, even though I knew it was amazing, I really struggled. But yeah, I could sell somebody else's.
Right.
And it's almost like the belief system. If you haven't got that belief system in yourself that you are capable of it, doesn't matter, you know, it could be a cure for Alzheimer's, for example. You'd really struggle to sell it if you didn't have some sort of self-worth. So what was the change for you then? Was it you getting this job and then you being able to see these additional skill sets being tagged onto your personality and your character? What was that change that helped develop this sort of self-confidence that you had?
Well, two things. First of all, cause and effect. So think about it. If the reason why product is rarely the problem, it's rarely the problem in early stage smaller businesses, because people don't know if your product's any good until after they've bought it. So if you can't get anybody to buy it, then it doesn't matter. Therefore, people never get the traction. Obviously, if you can learn how to sell and market, that comes first. But then you need a good product to be able to sustain that success, otherwise you'll get a bad reputation, etc. And therefore, the marketplace will find you out and you'll fall from grace. So it's cause and effect. But what caused the shift in me was getting around higher quality, higher caliber people. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, Dan. I'm not trying to put people down. But when I looked around, I mean, you've heard this is cliche, but most people hear it and dismiss it. I took it to heart. This was the single most important piece of advice I got in my life. And that is, you are the average of the 10 people you hang out with. And if I looked at the 10 people that I was spending the most time with, we were all broke. None of us had any money. We were all in debt. It was the blind leading the blind.
How long ago was this?
I'm going to say it's 10 years, maybe 11.
So sort of 10 years sort of sounds like it's a long time, but in the whole scheme of things, like, you know, if we live till we're 100, and obviously scientific advances are meaning that's more and more likely, 10 years is not that much. But then if you compare who you were hanging around with then to, like, this weekend just gone, you had your own event and Frank Kern turned up, obviously, that's just phenomenal. The journey that you've been on from where you were to where you are now has been really transitional.
Well, it's dramatic. So, yeah, I had dinner with Frank the other weekend after my event. I was on the phone with Jay Abraham last night, twice yesterday, actually. We were chatting up about a few things. And I don't say that to name drop. I say that because it has been a seismic shift. But actually,
you can name drop. It's pretty impressive.
But it's not about the 10 years, Danny. Like, a lot of it happened. You get the geometric growth, right? You know, most people listening to your podcast and getting your high quality information know about the value of compounded interest and kind of the geometric results you get if it's reinvested for massively bigger returns. Well, it's the same here. So with what I'm about to tell you, there's a little bit of advice that I got on how I took it to heart. I set the goal of clearing my £108,000 worth of debt in 12 months. I failed to do that, Dan. It took me 17 and a half months to clear that debt. Yeah. But in doing so, I then created a personal income that was of the level, which meant that, you know, in order for me to even start clearing the debt, I went from no money to a six-figure income at the age of whatever I was, 21, and it's only ever increased since then. So the actually in the early days saw a much more dramatic increase in my lifestyle than the growth that I've had in later years, despite the fact that it would seem outwardly like in the last year or two, my life has blown out of all proportion. But that's because of the foundations being put in place. But for me, from literally, Dan, having to scrabble down the back of the sofa to find the change because I broke up with my fiance at the time, and when I was dating again, wanted to take a girl I really liked out for a drink, and I didn't have the money to be able to do it. So I was scrubbing down the back of my parents' sofa to find a few pounds so I could go to, I could take her for a drink, buy her what she wanted, and get tap water for myself.
Yeah.
You know, that's a new level of pathetic. or for me it was at least. But from there to like a year later, having a pay slip in my hands for £8,000, £9,000, £10,000, and about 14, 15 months later, having a pay slip in my hands for £15,000 when I was working for this NLP training company. And then I knew that I'd mastered the skill. So I went off and started my own business again. But actually, that's not the distinction with this, Dan. It was hanging out with those better quality people. It was being what Jay Abraham would call being the dumbest person in the room.
Yep.
And I didn't really believe in myself, but one of my early mentors, a guy called Andy Harrington, who's a bit like Marmite. Some people absolutely love him and rave about him. Some people hate him. You've probably got a mix listening to this podcast if they've heard about him. But I obviously love him dearly and probably hate him too at times because we've got a very close brotherly relationship. But he saw something in me and he believed in me. And that's what I try to do when I coach people now, is see potential in themselves that they perhaps don't even see. They don't see it in themselves. See potential in them that they don't see in themselves. And
isn't that funny, don't you think, that you get people who are very capable, but their self-worth is just so low?
Well, all the evidence I had, Dan, supported that fact. It all supported that fact. It was that I had a failed business. I had no money. I'd never really made any money. I had a load of debt. I had, you know, friends and family tell me to go and get a job working for HSBC Bank. You know, it was miserable. I had no references for making money. And even though I had ideas, I had dreams, I had that niggling self-doubt. I had no evidence to back it up. And yet when I kind of went to work for Andy, I remember him looking at me and saying, Dan, look at those computers on those desks right there. In there is a database. In that database is the people that will give you the money to make, to give you the lifestyle that you want. He said, how much do you want to make? And I said, I want to make £50,000 a year. And that for me was unreal amount of money at the time. Like insane, like my biggest, loftiest goal. And he said, Dan, if you do what I tell you, you will make that money. Like it's there to be had inside those computers. And because he told me so congruently, because he sold me on the concept.
Yeah.
I believed him. And sure enough, within a year, I actually greatly surpassed the target. Because I'd modeled from him and learned from him, and he coached me and he mentored me. And Dan, I'm a huge fan, as you know. You know, I don't know about property. I've been meaning to get into property for years. So what did I do? I sought out a superb property coach. I'm speaking to him. I said, Dan, help me. I've got these ideas. I need to get involved in property. You said, do this. And within, I don't know what it was, 10 days of us working together. It was within 2 days I found my first deal, but that didn't end.
I think it was 8 hours. I think I emailed you later on that day after our first
session. Right, I was going to say, it was the next day we'd found the first deal, and now that, to be fully transparent, that one didn't end up closing because we got gazumped. But within the next week, so a few days later, 4 or 5 days later, we found the second deal, which I completed on close, that had enough equity in it that more than paid for the cost of the coaching, was cash flow positive. It was just unbelievable. It was incredible. And from there, your horizons are just expanded. So you need to believe that it's possible. You need to have the self-belief that it's possible. And the way that I was helped was people around me were telling me that it was possible. But really, they gave me the references that it was possible because they'd done it themselves.
That's it. Because something I want to pick up on, it's something you said earlier, you had no evidence to back up that you could be successful. And this is actually one of the things that having a mentor or a coach can do. And for you, it was Andy at the time, not in an official capacity, but as a sort of friendly sort of thing. And he gave you an external reference point. was most people listening to a podcast, if you're going through and you've got no evidence to back up you've been successful because you've never been successful, it's like, well, where do you get that from? And this comes back to your environment being really positive and powerful. And if the wife or the husband is just putting you down all the time, then you're not going to get that. But it, and your friends too, well, that'll never work. Well, my friend tried it and that didn't work. And if you live in that environment, you're never going to get there. So you have to create your own environment. And usually we would do that through a mentor who's got the belief in you and the systems and the resources, because they've already not only done it themselves, but they've helped hundreds of people do it.
Dan, I there is a direct correlation between how much money you invest in yourself and how much money you make. Yeah. Every single time that I've invested in myself, there has been a return. It's not always immediate. Sometimes there's a lag time. It's a bit like, you know, all right, with you, it was only a matter of days, but still, you know, you have to make the investment first, learn the skills, apply them, and then get the result. So sometimes that could be days, weeks, months, years. But, you know, for example, Dan, one time I bought a business that ended up being a train wreck and it nearly bankrupted me. And I'd got to the point in my life where, again, this was maybe 6 or 7 years ago now. So a long time ago, before I had kids, and yes, it might be 8 years ago, whatever, before I had kids, and I bought this business, and it was highly leveraged. So I'd used a lot of debt to buy it, even though I'd put a lump of money down. And I just got to the point in my life, Dan, where I had a reasonable amount of capital. I had, for the first time ever in my life, I had more than £100,000 in cash available, free and clear, after tax, etc., that I could invest and spend. But I ended up buying this business for, it was over $500,000, $500,000 or $600,000. I put about $30,000 down and the rest was finance. But the business nearly bankrupted me. However, ironically, what I learned from doing that business has made me countless, countless millions of pounds since that time, Dan.
Yeah.
It was the best kind of learning experience you could have had. And now, while that wasn't a traditional mentor in terms of the person I bought the business off, in some respects it was. So Dan, I have so many mentors. I'm involved in so many different mastermind groups, learning programs. I'm the secret to my success, if I could be so brash as to claim to be successful. So a better way would be to say the secret of the things that I've accomplished at this stage in my life are fundamentally, it boils down to one thing. I've been obsessed with learning. And I've been obsessed with learning from people who've already got results.
Yeah.
So that takes the form of formal paid coaching programs. That takes the form of informal mentors and advisors. It takes the form of paid mastermind groups. It takes the form of unpaid mastermind groups. It takes the form of seminars. It takes the form of books. It takes the form of CDs. It takes the form of, I can be away on holiday, Dan. A friend of mine now called Carl, we met, because I'm naturally a bit antisocial. I'm not the most social guy. I'm kind of quite introverted. So when I go on a holiday, I normally just see that as a chance to read, you know, a book a day while sat by the side of the pool. That's my kind of attitude. Yeah. And on one particular holiday, I ended up sat next to another family because my wife was talking with the wife of this particular family and our kids were playing together in the pool. So I ended up being sat by the husband who was equally sat there just reading his book. And we ended up having a conversation. It was like, hi, how are you? But rather than have the usual bollocks conversation, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but I have now. The usual kind of conversation. Oh, yeah, how are you? Where are you from? Blah, blah, blah. I just piled straight in with, what do you do?
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, I own my own business. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Tell me about that. Anyway, we ended up in a multi-hour-long conversation where he's talking about, you know, how he's really scared right now because his business is growing, but he's just being sued for the first time. And, you know, he's got a staff member that's looking to leave. And by the end of it, I ended up with a consulting client. and not because I was looking for the consulting client, but because I was genuinely interested in something I was passionate about, and I'm always looking to learn. And he'd done some really cool things in his business. He had a distribution business. He did distribution of nutritional supplements for horses, of all these things. But it was a big multi-7-figure business. So he had loads of cool stuff that I could learn from, and he had a few areas where he made some mistakes where I had experience, which meant that I could help him.
Do you find sometimes, like, I mean, I have this real problem of sort of fitting into normal people, like, and that sounds really awful, doesn't it? But just people get up and go to work 9 to 5. I really struggle having conversations sometimes because for me, it's always like, you know, what's your sales funnel looking like? What's your biggest problem? And I have that level of conversation. Do you struggle with that as well, or is it just me?
Well, I say I don't struggle, but that's probably because two reasons. One is I'm pretty antisocial, unfortunately, and this isn't a good thing, but my wife will tell you I can be pretty just, you know, I'm not exactly the life of the party. So unless I can get the conversation onto something pretty engaging, I'm relatively introverted and I won't engage, which is probably a social weakness of mine. But the second thing is I surround myself pretty much, Dan. Well, I don't avoid people. I'm happy to talk to anybody. Because there's always something you can learn from anybody.
Always. Yeah, I agree.
I haven't even started speaking about distressed acquisitions and things yet, but there's always something you can learn. But I know you can always learn from by just adding massive value to them just because that's how I want to live and how I want to show up. But actually, if I think about the people that I would class as my friends now, that they're people that stretch me massively beyond my wildest dreams. And to be honest, Dan, in my experience, there's one thing is making incremental improvements, and that's the thing that happens most of the time. But sometimes you're ready to make a gigantic leap, and that's the only way to grow. So, you know, a true story. When I was talking with Jay Abraham last night on the phone, we were talking about a business idea that I've got, and I was discussing it with Jay, and we speak, we speak semi-frequently, and I was picking his brains on it. And Jay is just, you know, one of the most mind-blowing people that I've ever met. From an intellectual point of view, he's just incredible, mind-blowing. Yeah. And we're having it. And basically, I presented what I feel is a pretty solid plan. It's worked for me in the past. It's made me a lot of money over my life. And I was making incremental changes to it. And Jay just absolutely ripped it apart and showed me different ways that you could add zeros to the money it was generating. And to be honest, like, on the one hand, I was super excited. But on the other hand, Dan, I was absolutely shit scared. Mm. I was like, but Jay, I haven't done this before and I don't know how to do it. And really, all I'm saying is I don't have any references for that level.
Yeah.
And Jay's response is, yeah, well, here's the 73 different examples of when I've done it or when I've done it for my clients, the results they worked, the obstacles that you're likely to encounter and how to overcome them, and therefore made me feel empowered. And I'm probably going to do the idea. Now, again, it doesn't mean that you should just take the advice of somebody who's perhaps achieved results that you want, because sometimes, again, there's lots of details that can make good advice, bad advice if it's implemented at the wrong time. But the point is, it's expanding my comfort zone and forcing me to think much bigger. I mean, Dan, you know, and probably everybody on this podcast has had an experience where they've spoken to somebody in the same industry or just with less life experience with them. And that person's freaked out, whether it be because of a relationship or whether it be a financial thing or a health thing or whatever. And they're freaked out because something's happened. You know, their child's misbehaving or, you know, the child's, you know, of a certain age and they're still wetting the bed or not reading well and they're freaked out that they're going to be disadvantaged for life. Yet, because you've had the references of helping your child overcome those obstacles or that you've overcome that health challenge or whatever, you're like, look, just relax. It's not a problem. Just do this and this and this and it'll be okay. Yeah. And then they go, oh, I'm not sure. You go, trust me, just do it. And then they do it and they get the result that they wanted or they resolve the problem. But for you, it was always self-evident.
Yeah.
And the only answer, Dan, is to hang out with much higher caliber people. When I say higher caliber, I don't mean that they're better than you in life in terms of making you feel inferior. I mean that they can teach you things. They're smarter than you and got better results in specific areas of life.
So they have specific skill sets that you can learn from. And for them, so for example, with Andy, selling from the stage, he's an absolute master at that. And he's a master at that because that's all he thinks about 24, 7 hours a day, you know? And you can learn from that. But that's not to say that he might be better at tennis than you are because you play more tennis than he does, for example. But it's just in that specific skill set. And I think that's the benefit of having a mastermind group because there's always someone who's got a better skill set than you, right?
Right. So, you know, again, it's always relative as well. So what I'm about to say may not be true for somebody on this call. But compared to some people on this call, I've perhaps got a more advanced knowledge of marketing and sales and things like that, or Infusionsoft, or investing. But there are people on the call that would dwarf me in terms of loads of other areas of life, whether it be in business or whether it be health, whether it be relationships. You know, and it's like, Dan, so we've worked together. You have got infinite more knowledge than I have on a property investment front, which was massively advantageous to helping me expand my property portfolio and learn how to do it. And I'm still massively in theory and got lots more to learn, which I hope I'll continue to do so. But yeah. But that doesn't mean that I'm less than you. Yeah, so people, I don't want people on this call to be feeling bad. It's like, no, I felt good about myself, but you just happen to have superior knowledge and I want the benefit from that knowledge.
I think sometimes the problem for people is asking for help, because as a coach, for example, you know, because I do business coaching and I do property coaching, and I'm very au fait with marketing and the systems that need to go in hand and so on. But again, I don't know everything, and I struggle with this, actually, can you help me with this? Because I don't know how to do that. And I think a lot of people struggle with just asking for help because it makes them look inferior. Whereas actually, asking for help is probably one of the most superior things that you could ever do.
It's the most endearing. It's the most endearing, yeah. Dan. In fact, I've got it. People love helping other people. So it makes you look good. And actually, oftentimes, it raises people's experience of you because nobody likes a bullshitter. Let me tell you a story, Dan. My father is an incredible man. I truly aspire to be like him in many ways. He's the life and soul of the party. He's incredible with children. You know, he's the kind of person that used to give up all his free time. You know, he ran the Cubs and the Scouts and the local kids football team and the squash team, you know, and the Sunday school. And, he dedicated his life to service because of experiences he had when he was a child. He said that when he grew up and he was in a position to do so, he would commit himself to helping children develop themselves.
Brilliant.
So my whole family, and that's kind of like why I've got the Love to Learn book. I've always been involved in learning lots of different interesting, cool things, and that's kind of come from him. But so I say all that first because I'm about to say something negative about my dad.
Okay.
My dad had one bad habit, which was he didn't like to look foolish. So oftentimes he'd be talking with somebody, and if they'd say something he didn't know, he would pretend like he knew.
Right. Okay.
What they were talking about, and I would know that he didn't know. I can't think of an example, but I would think that they didn't know, and he would then try and carry on the conversation as though he was in the know. But that was, you know, one of the only things that my dad ever did in my eyes that was negative, that made me think less of him. But it was a plan that he had that was to protect himself because he didn't want to feel stupid, because he values intelligence and he's a very intelligent man. So when it would come up, he would kind of act like he knew what he was talking about. But I saw that, I hated it so much, Dan. I absolutely detested it, because sometimes the other person would know and sometimes they wouldn't. So they wouldn't know, but then my dad wouldn't get the benefit of learning, or they would know, in which case they'd think he was a bullshitter. And he's not a bullshitter. He would never do it to take advantage of people. He was trying to just stay in rapport with people. But by doing that, actually, if they thought he was a bullshitter, you're disconnecting from people. When actually, he's a fast, sharp learner. And if he just said, hey, I'm sorry, could you just clarify what that means? And it endears you. And often it will endear you to other people that are listening. So I remember one time, Dan, I was on a call. So like I kind of... Oftentimes you adopt the habits of your parents, but sometimes you create the inverse of that. You know, sometimes people whose parents are very unhealthy or smoke, their kids swear they'll never smoke or something, et cetera. So I swore that I would become very good at doing that, because in my late teens, I noticed that I was doing it more and more, bullshitting. And I didn't like it. So I kind of made a mental shift one day and said, no, I'm always going to ask. And I remember one time, Dan, I was being paid a fortune in consulting fees to help this American company fill seminar rooms. And I've got a lot of experience in marketing of seminar rooms specifically. And we were talking and they used this acronym that I didn't understand. And I don't remember what it was now, but I'm going to say it was FAB. And they kept saying all right, what's the FAB cost? And it was a conference call with me, them, and it was several members of their team in different offices. So they're discussing it, and it's not being asked directly to me. They're not asking me what the FAB cost is, because otherwise I would have had to say, I don't know. And at first, I found myself just listening along, and I realized that the conversation was getting more complex from a financial analysis perspective, and I didn't have an effing clue what FAB cost was. So I realized...
Maybe that's what the F stood for.
Yeah. So I was like, right, I need to speak up. So I spoke up and I said, guys, look, I'm really sorry. Maybe I'm mishearing you and you're saying something I do understand, but I'm just mishearing you. Or maybe it's called something different in the US, but what does FAB stand for? And the one of the people went, oh, yeah, it's insured. That means food and beverage. was the food and beverage costs attached to the hotel. Like, what are we committed to contractually to provide food for the delegates? And I went, oh, okay, I totally understand. Okay, great, that's, would I have a slightly different language in the UK? Great, I can now follow on with the conversation. So two things happened. First of all, it wasn't a problem. It was only a problem in my head that I might look stupid to these people that pay me a fortune. But actually, it didn't. They just understood. I hadn't heard that particular term in that way.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was, after the call, Dan, somebody else who worked at the company that was part of that team, who'd recently been promoted into that role, rang me up and said, Dan, I just want to thank you so much. I said, why? I didn't really contribute much to that call. It was more of a fact find. I was finding out information. He said, I had no clue what FAB stood for either.
So the only silly question is one that's never asked, right?
Right, right. So I will literally say, well, guys, I go, forgive me. Sorry, this may sound like a stupid question, but I don't understand, and I'm asking the question so I can help you better.
Of course. I mean, part of success is checking understanding. So when I do coaching calls, and I'm sure I've done it with you, I will say something, and then I will check back with you to make sure that you've actually understood what I've said. So there's three sections to communication: with sending a message, receiving a message, and making sure the message is understood. Most people simply send messages out, they never check if they've been received, and they certainly don't check if they've been understood. And if you didn't know what the food and beverage was, that could actually have quite a negative effect on the event that you were putting on.
Oh, of course it could. It could have downstream significantly. I couldn't add the value. But Dana, I'll ask you, when I'm not supposed to be the expert. I mean, you know, we'll have a coaching session and you will advise me on some specific detail about refurbishment or something, or getting a remortgage or whatever. And I'll get off the phone, and then 2 days later I'll come to implement it, and I will have forgotten is a very simplistic fact, but I've just forgotten and I'm not sure. And I'll get in touch and go, Dan, I'm sorry, like, how long did you say it needed to be before I remortgaged? Or how much do you think I should be looking to pay for the roofing tiles to be replaced? And I could pretend and kind of crack on with it and then get a nasty surprise when I do something stupid because I've cash flowed it that I could remortgage in 3 months when it could be 6 months, or I've only budgeted for, you know, £500 for redoing the roof or the boiler or something, when actually you said 5,000, but I missed a zero off my numbers, and that turns it from being a good deal to a bad deal. And you know what? I can't even recall a time, Dan, when I've asked one of those mind-numbingly simple questions that the other side has been anything other than happy to help and then clarify the point.
Yeah, and I think people, they'll go out of the way to help you. So talk to me a little bit more about, you mentioned about acquisition of assets. So this is basically buying businesses. So before we go down that path, just transition me from, so you were working for an NLP company, and then you started working for yourself, putting bums on seats doing seminars, I'm assuming, but you can clarify. And then you moved into buying businesses. Can you just go through that transition for me?
Yeah, the very high-speed version of this. I was working for myself. I gradually hired one or two employees to kind of grow the business, and it worked. The business was very much dependent upon me. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that business model. You know, one of my mentors, Keith Cunningham, says that he was the guy that kind of taught Robert Kiyosaki what he knows. He was a mentor to Robert Kiyosaki about the cash flow quadrant. And he said, and Keith's opinion is, Robert teaches that you should be a B or an I, as in running your own business or be an investor, and not be self-employed or employed. Otherwise, you're a loser. And Keith goes, I don't agree with that. He says, Andy Murray, right, who's obviously playing at the moment at Wimbledon, Andy Murray is self-employed.
Yeah, he's a specialist.
Right, and he gets a phenomenally high income. Now, it is true to say that if he got injured and couldn't continue to play, like if his career was permanently ended, that would be the loss of much of his income. But, you know, what, are you trying to say that if somebody was a property investor and they had one buy-to-let property with 15 grand of equity and £150 positive cash flow a month, they are not a financial loser, but Andy Murray is? Clearly that's lunacy. Of course, the question for somebody like and Andy Murray would be, you can do that, but then you've got to take that money and invest it in a way that does secure you. And I don't.
Andy's still exchanging time for money, believe it or not.
Well, yeah, no, he is, but that's the point, because he's got such a highly leveraged way of getting it. So the amount he gets paid per hour now is so exponentially high. It makes sense for him to do that. Of course, and I'm sure what he's got his advisors doing, just to be clear, I don't know Andy Murray, but I'm sure what he's got his advisors doing is investing his income that he's generating into assets to produce wealth. Yeah. And that's what I started trying to do. So because I knew business, I just saw the opportunity to do a couple of offshoot businesses. So I had a couple of offshoot businesses. And then somebody approached me with the intention of buying their business. That's the one that nearly bankrupted me. And even though it nearly bankrupted me in the short term, because I grossly overpaid for the business and made loads of mistakes,
yep,
what I learned from it enabled me to buy other businesses very efficiently. Because the interesting thing for me, Dan, is this. And then I'll tie it into kind of a dramatic life event for me a few years ago, if you want to. But I'm a fan of property investment, obviously. So every on this podcast, great. I'm a huge fan of it. I do. I'm an active investor, and I'm looking to rapidly increase my portfolio. But the advantage in businesses is more exponential. See, one of the advantages of property is the price of the asset is relatively fixed, in the sense of, yes, you can buy BMV. And sometimes with the right, you know, value, you can get it valued at a slightly, but the spread isn't going to be that dramatic. You know, no. It's very.
And even in a crash, it's not that dramatic. That's 20% max.
That's what I mean. You're going to see 20. I was going to say 20%. And there might be freak occurrences where you sometimes get more than that, but not really. Now, that's good because that means your asset base is relatively stable and you can produce an income from it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. With businesses, there's no such thing. So the value of a business varies massively. So the value of a four-bedroom property in, you know, Leeds city centre, well, there wouldn't be a four-bedroom probably in Leeds city centre, but four-bedroom property in a certain suburb of Leeds is going to be X plus or minus 10% and maybe minus 20% if it's extraordinarily distressed and you have the ability to move very quickly. But the valuation of a business can move by hundreds of percent based upon who the buyer is and how they're strategically positioned to take advantage of the situation. And the marketplace for buying time businesses is far more undefined. Let me give you a good example just to illustrate this point, Dan. I had a business that I wanted to sell, and it was only a little business and it was struggling. I had somebody offer me £40,000 cash for that business. 6 months later, and I was considering doing it, 6 months later, I sold that business for $300,000 in cash.
Wow.
And nothing dramatic happened in the business in that period of time. So the business didn't double in size. It didn't add loads of new products. It didn't get loads of new customers. There was only one difference, and that is I found a buyer who could extract much more value from the business than the first person who offered the $40,000. That was it. The business was worth much more in their hands because of how they could leverage it. Whereas, you know, a property, the reason why it's relatively fixed is because the income is relatively fixed. You know, you're only going to get, even if you refurb it, you know, it's only going to adjust the rent by so much. Even if you did a full-on HMO conversion, that's going to increase the yield you can get from that property, but you spent a lot of money to achieve that, and it's still, the spread is comparatively minor, whereas one business there, that example, I just showed you how I got eightfold the valuation. Imagine if you could get an 800% increase in your property valuation, Dan, in 6 months without spending,
that would be happy
without
days.
Spending any money on the property.
Yeah. And we get 5% and, you know, 5% a year on average, I reckon it's probably about 3.5-4 actually, but 5%, you know. So interestingly, Ben, how did you get into, so first of all, you have to recognize that this asset has the opportunity to increase and it has the opportunity to be worth zero as well, you know, based on bad news, new technological innovations come out and makes the business not as sophisticated, for example. But how did you get into looking at, so you got this first deal and you eventually got out of it. How did you then go, do you know what, I can do this on a regular basis?
Well, it's references. So first of all, I had to learn a new skill set and I got references for people that had done it.
And that skill set was what,
well,
specifically?
A variety. I mean, I learned from somebody about distressed acquisitions, i.e. doing turnarounds on businesses that are failing, that are racked with debt. I learned about just buying businesses straight up, you know, using cash, but leverage potentially from the bank. And I saw all other kind of interesting permutations as well that weren't business acquisitions or mergers, but they were like mergers, there were licensing arrangements, there were franchising arrangements.
Yes.
And again, I wish I could say there was this one definitive source. There wasn't. There's a lot of stuff out there, and I just learned, applied, got into conversations with higher caliber business owners who'd done mergers, who'd done deals, who'd bought, who'd sold, who'd, you know, I met a guy called Lyndon quite recently, who's a friend of somebody who's in my peer group, in my mastermind group. And Lyndon got something like 8 days away from closing. He did a year's worth of due diligence and he was 8 days away from closing on an eight-figure deal. But anyway, a multi-million pound cash deal, selling his company to like a large competitor in the marketplace, and it all fell apart. Well, I was fascinated to find out why and how he would do it differently and how he is trying to do it differently this time. And that, Dan, it comes back to, and again, this sounds a little, forgive me, listeners, if this sounds vague and ambiguous, but it boils down to, are you constantly evolving the people that you're hanging out with? Are you constantly refining it? It's not so you get rid of people that can no longer add value to you. No. You know, there's loads of people in my life that I love them for who they are and I want to add value to them. But in addition to that, I consistently seek out and will drive or even fly a long way, Dan, to sit down and have dinner with somebody. You know, earlier this year, I flew to Mallorca to have dinner and a few hours in an evening with a gentleman who was very experienced in kind of big M&A, mergers and acquisition type deals, just to hang out with him. And we did. And you know what? Ideas came off the back of it that have made me a lot of money. So it was perfect. But it's sometimes, like I say, it's formal. You've got to invest big money. Like, you know, Jay, okay, great. I'm working with Jay now and I'm fortunate enough to have his mobile number and we speak on the phone. But originally that came at a very, very big price, let me assure you. And I had to write that check. But then once the relationship's established, you continue to reap the rewards of that relationship. So there's no definitive answer. But guys, the best thing you do if you're listening to this call is to ask yourself, if you're looking specifically to develop your property portfolio, who do you have in your circle that you're spending time with that you can benefit from? Are you leveraging Dan for the property coaching and the mentoring or the business coaching? Or who else do you know? Because it's never just one person.
No, it's never just one.
You know, if I told you the amount of money that I invest in myself still to this day, a lot of people would be stunned at the size of the number. Now, some people, I'm not going to share the number, but if I did, some people would foolishly go, would rather foolishly and to their detriment go, oh, well, that's easy. That's because Dan's, you know, been doing it 10 years and he's very successful, so he's got the money to spend. But actually, it's cause and effect. The reason why I'm continuing to spend that much money, I could maintain my current lifestyle without spending the money. I'm reinvesting a large proportion of my income to continually grow and go to the next level.
Yeah.
And that's what you've got to do. And that's what I've always done, even when I didn't have the money. I'm not suggesting people be reckless and, you know, remortgage their house and pawn their children to get investing necessarily. But I am suggesting that I believe, as Jim Rohn would say, your personal income rarely exceeds your personal development.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely could not agree more with the late, great Jim Rohn on that sentiment. It's not always directly linear in terms of time scales, because sometimes there's lag times and things. So you may not spot it. But over time, there is a distinct and definitive trend between income and investments. And I believe for the people listening to this call, the most important investment you can make is not into property, not into your business. It's into yourself.
Yeah. So I've got two questions, and then I want to move on to a life event that you had, which probably changed a few things up, which I want to talk to you about. But so the two questions, first of all, the first one is, how do you find a mastermind group? So what's your basis? What are you looking for in that mastermind group? Are you looking for a specific, well, we're all marketers and all we do is talk about marketing, or do you drill down even further? We're all copywriters and we just, you know, for 2 days we discuss nothing but copywriting, or are they a mixture of different skill sets within a marketing group, and how do you find them?
This can be a really infuriating interview because I'm not going to give a straight answer to any question. But the answer is all of the above. So, Dan,
awesome.
I have a very clear, defined plan for my life, and that plan is broken up into the different areas of my life, whether it be my health and fitness, whether it be my personal wealth, whether it be my...
Hang on a second, Dan. I thought life just happened to you. Are you saying that's not true, that you can actually plan it?
Right. Right, and by the way, I'm not a natural planner at all.
But no, me neither.
I've learned that it's a necessity because, you know, it's life goes by. In fact, side note, Dan, one of the most, if you want a simple takeaway, anybody that's still listening to me yabber on after an hour, a thing that changed my life recently, even though I practiced this before, but it kind of recommitted me to the process, and it's actually a pretty terrible book, is a book called Miracle Morning.
Okay.
And in that book, let me look it up because the guy's name escapes me really quick. In that book, the gentleman who wrote it basically said, look, you know, you want your life to change, you want your life to be better, you want to have better health and fitness, you want to have more money, you want to be more educated. Hal Elrod is his name, H-A-L, first name, Elrod, E-L-R-O-D. Hal Elrod. He basically goes, you need to make it happen. And if you wait till the end of the day also fit it in, it's never going to happen. Life's going to take over. You've got your spouse, you've got your kids, you've got your dog, you've got your other family, you've got your friends, you've got your, you know, life. You've got your work or your business. I don't know about you, Dan, but like when I started out in business, I thought, oh yeah, when I make all this money, then I'll have all this free time.
Yeah.
That's not true. Now, let me be succinct. It could be true if I was happy to plateau, if I was happy to level, because I got more effective at doing certain things. But actually, because I'm investing in growth, I'm busy, man. I'm busy, but I'm busy doing stuff that I love, that I enjoy. And while some of that's obviously personal, family time, etc., a good chunk of it is investment in myself for future growth.
Yeah.
And Hal basically puts forward in this book, the only solution is to do it first thing in the morning. So Dan, I am a night owl. My natural nature was always to go to bed at 2-3 in the morning, get up at 8-9 o'clock, you know, and kind of crack on. That's how I've operated for years. When I got kids, all right, it moved, and a wife, I got a bit more domesticated, but I'd still often be up at 12, 1, 2. That was pretty common. Yeah. And I was kind of relatively begrudging of this sleep. And this book basically was like, right, get up an hour earlier. So now, Dan, I'll tell you, I read this book and it just switched something in my brain. And for the first time in my life, even though because I do manage my own diary, I've been fortunate enough to be able to get up relatively late given the kids and still exercise or work out in the morning before I sit down to do some work. I've been able to do that. But now, Dan, I'll tell you, I wake up naturally 4 or 5 a.m., get up, and I've got an hour or two before any of the kids are even awake. And you know what? That's the most productive time of the day. By the time most people have got up and had their breakfast, Dan, I have done a day and a half's worth of work.
Wow, amazing. So we led on to that because the question was, how do you find a mastermind?
Oh, right. Yeah,
you mentioned all of the above.
So
then I think underlying that was this idea that actually you do a lot more planning these days than you ever have done, even though you're not a natural planner.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you were keeping track of it. See, I obviously didn't plan my answer to the question. So I seek out actively coaches, mentors, or just friends who can help me in each of those areas. Okay? So in pretty much, I'm just checking mentally now to see. It's not true to say I've got a mentor in each of these areas of my life at the moment, but I've got a mentor in most, and I've got a development plan for myself in all of the areas. So whether
and what are those specific areas?
So you've got health and fitness.
Yeah.
You've got kind of emotional well-being.
You've got, that's interesting, because how many people have a coach for emotional well-being? Not many.
Right. You've got spiritual, like the spiritual side of your life.
Yep.
I've got my intimate relationship with my wife.
Yep.
I've got my other family. So that obviously includes my children. So the children, you know, the parenting advice and learning that I'm doing is specific to them, but also just making sure that I'm constantly being a better, not just father, but son, brother, etc.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've lost track of what I've said now. I've also got wealth, personal wealth.
Yep. And that wealth's going to be broken down into several succinct areas. So you've got property in there. What else have you got?
I've got property. I've got stock market. I've got other investments. I do a lot of money lending, for example. I lump a lot of things together in there for personal wealth because there's a chunk of stuff that I keep over in business specifically. But property, stocks, and other investments. That's kind of like my relatively passive portfolio, if you want to call it that. And I make sure that I'm obsessive about money management as well, Dan. Some of you think that the biggest lesson for me in the last few years, in many ways, I'm a lot fortunate than most. I've been fortunate to be a high income earner for 10 years since I went to work for Andy Harrington and started out on my own business, basically. But my net worth did not keep track with my income for most of that time. So a few years ago, when I had a life-threatening accident, whilst, okay, I didn't have any debt and I had a little bit of assets, if you looked at my income for the past 10 years and you looked at my assets, you'd be saying, are you effing kidding me?
Yeah. I was going to say, obviously, when you had your accident, your income stops because you haven't got any assets.
Right. And that was exactly, that was basically the distinction. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, my wife and I had one buy-to-let property, which was cash flow positive. And okay, we had a bit of money in savings, ISAs and things. Yeah. And there were a few other very minor things. But in the big picture, in the grand scheme of things, Dan, I had nothing. I had nothing. And I realized when I, because at one point in the experience, when I was in the hospital, I thought I might die. Or at the very least, I thought, because I ended up with a brain injury. I was in a Ironman triathlon and basically came off the bike and went head first into a tree and ended up with brain damage. And at one point, I don't know if you've ever seen a TED talk. There's a TED talk done by a brain scientist who had a stroke and it took her 7 years to recover. But she talks about the experience in graphic detail of what she had when she had that stroke, of how she could literally feel her mental faculty disappear and how she lost the ability to read and move her right side of her body and she could no longer recall names. And as the blood vessel exploded in that side of her brain and as the blood seeped out and affected her mental function, I had a very similar experience. And I remember as I was going down, so to speak, I remember thinking, holy shit, like literally my wife, my children, okay, that, you know, yes, I'm relatively covered. They won't have to work for a few years. Ultimately, they will have to work. And actually, if I look at what I've, my income, that is pathetic. That really is. I have done myself a great disservice. So following that accident, I became obsessed, Dan, with building personal net worth. So what, one bit of advice, which I got, a few people probably give me, but the person that got me to actually do it was a guy called Jeremy Harbour.
Okay.
And was doing a personal balance sheet every month.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the, part of the education I'd embarked on was learning how financials work to analyze companies. Cause I used to think, Dan, if you just sell enough, you're going to make money.
Of course.
Yeah. What an absolutely mentally retarded perception. It's not true in the slightest.
That comes from not knowing any better or being educated any differently because the media, the school system gears us up to. And, you know, the media, you know, if you take a look at Floyd Mayweather, he made, I don't know, 300 million, whatever it was. He's got zero assets, so he'll spend that and then he'll have to go and fight again to make more money and he'll just spend it like Mike Tyson.
That I was going to say, like Mike Tyson. It's not,
he went bust.
It's not uncommon. There's a difference between income and wealth. And you need to, well, I think you need to create income to create wealth. And that's not true if you naturally inherit wealth, I suppose. But really, your income, you need to then invest in assets. So what you cover on this podcast is exactly right. How do you make sure you're bringing the income in, you're not wasting money, so you're cutting your expenses, so you've not got unnecessary waste, and then you're investing the difference, that surplus, into assets that can build real wealth for you. So I became obsessed with it, and that's when I became really obsessed with buying and selling companies, because I see a lot of, I've had a lot of friends, Dan, who have had success in business. I've seen a lot struggle in business and always have the dream, but never achieve it. And I've seen people have successful businesses where they were making a lot of money and their lifestyle just expanded to meet their income. And then when the business became struggled and had a downturn or went bust, even if it was through no fault of their own, they were screwed because they had all this high expenditure that was tied to their high income and they had no asset base. So, and actually, Dan, a lot of business owners, they had the chance to exit. So if you look at like all the Dragons on Dragon's Den, for example, nearly all of them built their wealth. It's changed with the recent panel, but before, all of them had had the most significant wealth built by the exit of a business. So Duncan Bannatyne sold the care homes. Theo Pepitas bought the Senza for £1.
Yeah.
And then sold it on. And then it got in trouble again. And he did the other shops on the high street as well. Deborah Meehan sold the family holiday parks, et cetera. So, you know, the wealth is built by the creation of the asset and the selling of that asset. Now, while there's an argument for, hey, if the asset's good and income producing, you know, like if I've got a business that makes 3 million profit a year, and it's very solid business, Dan, so I could sell it on a 5x multiple. I could sell it for 15 million quid cash, get the cash,
Yeah.
But by the time I paid the capital gains tax on that, I'm down at, let's say, 12 million, just to, for simple maths. Let's say I've got 12 million. Well, you show me where the hell I can invest 12 million to get 3 million a year.
Yeah.
And the answer is, well, you can't, probably, in a secure way. Therefore, you're probably more secure staying in business. However, however, and this is a big however, black swan events happen all the time. And if the business is dependent upon you, even if you don't, even if you're not day to day every day, if you went by the wayside and the business started to decline, you know, it's a lot less fixed and a lot less secure than like property is, for example.
So it's interesting because my take on wealth, because most people live monthly, you know, they get a paycheck at the end of the month. And so I modeled my income based on that as well. And that's exactly what happens. All my rent comes in on more or less anyway, on the first of each month. So I'm in profit on the second. All my costs go out at the end of the month. So I've always got a chunk of cash in the bank. But I get paid monthly. So if I'm short of cash 1 month because I need a new boiler or whatever, I just wait, I hold my breath for 30 days and more cash comes back in. And that for me is really solid, reliable, long-term income. But I think it has to be a combination of both. So for me, there's two income sources. The first one is run rate, which is residual income coming in each month. And I got this when I worked at Dell. We would sell laptops and PCs and printers by the hundreds and thousands. And that would come in every month. We wouldn't have to do anything. The second type of a bids, these are the big things that we go out and do. So for you, it's buying and selling businesses. So you've got some businesses that are generating cash on a monthly basis, and that's great. It covers all your costs. But when the big stuff comes in, that's when you can either sell that business on, if that's what you want to do, and then move that money into whatever the next asset base is going
to
be.
Well, so I agree with you entirely, Dan. So to kind of tie this down specifically, because you probably put it more succinctly than I did.
Okay.
The reason why the business is interesting and you should consider at least having your business prepared for exit is because the valuations can be massive. So, you know, if you only own one buy-to-let investment property, right? And let's say you're making 10% on your money, right? Just to keep the math nice and simple.
Yeah.
Okay? And you're happy, et cetera. And let's say that property is worth £100,000. That's the market value. If somebody comes and offers you below market value and you've got nowhere to invest that money where you can make up what you were getting, then that wouldn't make sense. If they offered you market rates, it may or may not make sense, depending on if you had another deal prime and ready to go that would give you a better yield and you felt it was more secure, a better return on that capital, then you might go, well, okay, then I'll do it. There'll be risks, of course, associated with doing it and the taxes and whatever and the fees, but it might be worthwhile depending on how good an opportunity you felt you had in hand. If, however, somebody offered you £200,000 in cash for that £100,000 house and it was all legitimate, you'd be foolish not to snap their hand off.
Yeah.
And yet this happens in businesses all the time. Because if you asked the company that I sold that business for 300 grand to, if you said, was that a good investment? Because, you know, Dan was going to sell it for 40 grand just 6 months previous. Yeah. They would tell you it absolutely was a stunning investment.
Yeah.
And the reason I know that is because I've been in negotiation with them since then on selling them other businesses.
Right, okay.
because they're growing quickly and that's part of their plan for growth. And therefore, they've got the ability to leverage income because you say, well, why would somebody pay 200 grand for a 100 grand house? Well, they wouldn't. But using that theory as an example, if they had a secret plan which only they could use, which meant that they could get 10 times the rent from that property you could in a perfectly legitimate way, you know, whatever that is, then, you know, it would be like, let's say that there was loads of diamonds buried beneath the property and they'd already secured the license, which meant that only they could be allowed to extract all these diamonds, but they have to buy the property as well. That's the last piece in the puzzle. And it's going to make them millions of pounds. Then clearly it's going to make sense for them to pay too grossly overpay for the market value of the property.
So there's two things I just want to finish up on. The first one is, and I want to finish up with your accident and what the recovery process was, if that's okay. But I want to cover that at the end. But the just before we get there, how do you find or how do you go about finding distressed acquisitions for businesses? And I suppose as well, what do you say to the owner once you've found one?
Okay.
And you've got like 5 minutes because I'm just very aware of your time. Five or 10 minutes.
I've got it.
I'm just aware of your time.
First of all, what is a distressed acquisition? A distressed acquisition is basically where somebody will sell you below market value.
Yeah.
Right? Now, because of businesses, this can vary massively. So in effect, you need to find businesses that are in trouble. Now, I don't want to open a can of worms, make this too complicated. Basically, okay. You need to find businesses that are struggling. So any indicators that businesses are struggling is helpful, whether they're not there just late paying the bills, whether they've had to make some staff redundant, whether they're a friend of a friend and they're just stressed about it. What I would say, though, is it's quite hard to find them. You don't want to find them when they're already in insolvency. That's a bit like finding a property when it's already been foreclosed. It could be a good deal. It could be a good deal. But it's now in a big inside a big conglomerate, there's all kinds of rules and legislation which makes it much more complicated. Whereas if you can find it where they're up to their eyeballs in it before it goes, and you can turn it round. So you're finding people that are in trouble, that have got debts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then what do you say to them? Basically, in one sentence, I can solve your problem. I mean, really, that's it. So, Dan, for example, there was a business that I was involved with that was 300 grand in the hole, right? And there was stuff that was personally guaranteed by the director. There was a lot less than that, but there was money that was personally guaranteed. So, effectively, the business is going to go bust. And when it goes bust, they're going to come after him personally, and he's going to lose his house because the equity in his house isn't even going to cost. Because when they do it and they sell it, it's not even going to cover the costs. He's going to barely cover the cost of the mortgage, let alone the cost of the debts that he'd personally guaranteed to the business. So I went to him, and it was a specialist printing company. And I went to him and went, right, let me understand what's going on. Let me understand the problem. Great. All right. If I can get you off, what do you want? And he said, well, I don't want to lose my house. I said, okay. The only way you're going to lose your house, though, is if you this personal guarantee gets called in. What's the value of that equipment that you've guaranteed? And I don't remember the number, honestly, now. Let's say it was like 50 grand. I went, right, okay. So you've got 50 grand of personal guarantees. Am I right? So in other words, if you could get that debt paid off, that 50 grand, then the business might still go bust, but you wouldn't lose your house. He's like, that's right. I went, right, great. I said, so if I could guarantee that you could walk away and have your 50 grand, and not that guarantee doesn't get called in, would you give me your business? Because you've just told me that it's going to close. You've just told me that it's running out of time. And he came back and said, well, no, because I think it's got value. And I'm like, okay. So, all right, well, how are you going to solve the problem? And of course, he didn't have the answers. And I said, well, it seems to me like, you know, literally bailiffs are turning up daily. You know, it seems to me like, and the staff haven't been paid for a month. Like, you've got very severe problems. And by the way, it doesn't always have to be this much trouble. I just like particularly tough challenges, apparently. I said, so unless you've got a problem, you're going to lose it. I said, if you don't have an alternative plan, how can I help? And we negotiated, and I ended up with 40% of the company for helping him solve the problem. So I didn't put any money in, no money, but I said that I would help him get rid of that debt. So in exchange for helping him get rid of that debt and not have the guarantee, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it would work. And lo and behold, in a very short space of time, well, relatively short space, we'd written off 300 grand's worth of debt.
Amazing. What did you do specifically to turn that business around? I'm assuming they had some income, they had a database that wasn't being mined. What happened to turn that business around?
Well, it does vary radically between different businesses. So let me break it into categories. In a lot of cases, if it's a business worth buying, it's a business that's already got income streams. So this particular company had lots of contracts with big blue chips. And governments, they printed things like ballot papers, just so you know.
Okay.
And driving licenses and stuff like that. So one thing is negotiating with the creditors, because some of it's the cash flow. And if they had just be bought enough time, again, it's interesting with what's going on with Greece at the moment. If they just bought enough time, they can get it back on its feet. Because you've got to remember, you've got to know. So part one is like everything to do with insolvency law. Okay. So insolvency law, which is a bit that probably turning people off from this, but it's not as complex as you think. But in the simplest terms, if the business goes bust, nobody gets paid. Therefore, you just need to have a good pitch as to how you're going to fix it and how they're better off taking 50p in the pound than losing everything, which is what's going to happen. Okay. And again, I'm not commenting for or against Greece. I've got some very strong views on that. But all I'm saying is that's one potential argument. Okay. And so there can be things that are done there. And sometimes HMRC say, okay, this company screwed up, but we're making a fortune every month in PAYE tax. So we'll let the company keep running. We'll extend the terms you've got to pay your VAT bill, or we'll reduce the amount you have to pay, or whatever, because it's in HMRC's better interest for the business to keep going. That's one part of the equation. Another part of the equation is expenses. It's everything you teach, Dan. Expenses. What unnecessary expenses can be cut out of the business? Because oftentimes a business owner thinks that they're running it the best way, but they're not. They're wasting loads of money. They need to move into a smaller facility. They need to make a tough call and lay off some staff.
They're blinded by ego.
That's exactly what it is.
What I would call a cold equation. You know, I can save 20 staff, but I have to let 17 go. Well, you save your 20 staff. Otherwise, you lose all 37.
Right. Well, a company just a few miles from here that's in my kind of industry, unfortunately, recently, it was a great and fast-growing business, but unfortunately, there was something that happened behind the scenes. And again, it was nothing untoward. It was just a series of cock-ups, which meant that the product they were selling was good and they were making loads more sales than ever before. But in effect, they overexpanded and they ended up in a big problem. And it meant that they had to lay off half the staff, and it was dozens of people. But I actually went in, I found out about this, went in, met with the owner, and sat down and said, hey, let's call him Peter for the purpose of this conversation, said, hey, Peter, let me help you. We can fix this. And he basically said, I don't know you well enough, Dan. No. And this was before he laid the staff off. So I was like, let me help you. Because again, sometimes I do invest money. So I was open to investing money, depending on the terms. And he said, no. And then he ended up laying off a load of the staff. And then he didn't lay off enough. So he had to lay off more. But there were loads of other things he could have done to solve the problem, I feel. And so consequently, and it was a great business. They did really good products and really helped people. And fortunately, the business still does exist, but it's a shadow of its former self, because I feel that he didn't play the right cards. Not because I necessarily am right, even though I think I might have been helpful in this situation. It's not about me being right. It was that I do believe that his ego got in the way, or his fear. Because he'd never been through that scenario before. He didn't have the references. And I failed him because I lacked the skill and the persuasion to influence him about how this route probably would have yielded a much better outcome. So there's cutting the expenses. There's the insolvency side of the equation. There's cutting the expenses. And then there's leveraging the business to generate more revenue.
And what did you do in that specific situation?
So they had contracts with the big blue chips. We persuaded them to place larger orders, orders, pay on better payment terms, and we gave them other advantages and perks, which meant it was in their interest worthwhile to do so that they were committed for longer terms, which made the company more secure financially. We cut out some unnecessary expense. We went through an insolvency procedure to negotiate with the creditors to remove some of the debt.
Okay, so I just want to move on. Thanks for that, by the way. I mean, I've made a page of notes, by the way, here, so I'm hoping everybody listening is, if you're not driving, is also making notes. And I've got a page full, by the way, so thank you very much for that. Where do people find out more information about you or sign up to like a mailing list? Where would people go for that?
Well, you can just Google me, but you can find me at danbradbury.com. I mean, I'm on a lot of different websites. A lot of people, like you mentioned the Frank Kern event, that business is called Business Growth Systems, businessgrowthsystems.co.uk. But if you just go to danbradbury.com, I'm just redoing that site actually. So at the moment, I think it actually takes you to the Business Growth Systems website. But yeah, come on, check me out. I've got a lot of different business interests. So my intention on the relaunch of danbradbury.com, it will give you links to the various different fun and things that I'm doing, whether it be the money lending I do to small businesses, whether it be the buying and selling of businesses, whether it be the teaching people marketing, sales marketing education, or whether it be some of the other businesses that are a little bit more abstract and outside of the remit of this call, but are quite cool and quirky.
Perfect. And so I just want to finish up with, so you had this life-changing accident, you were doing an Ironman and you were on the bike, so that's the middle stage, isn't it? How far around the course were you on the bike?
Well, annoyingly, I couldn't have done it at the start because it's a Wimbledon ball. I was doing this Ironman 70.3, so it's a half Ironman, and a 56-mile bike. So it's a 1.2-mile swim, 56-mile bike, half marathon at the end. And I did it the previous year, and it was the most gut-wrenching thing I ever had to do. Okay. And I ended it again because my brother-in-law, who did it with me the first year, failed to finish. So I did it again with him to try and get round. And I was...
So it's your brother-in-law's fault. Then.
Well, basically, yeah. I was 50 miles into the bike race and when the accident happened. So, and it is his bloody fault because I'd already lost him by this point in proceedings anyway. He still didn't bloody finish.
Right, okay. And so you came off your bike, you hit a tree, you split your helmet in two, I believe.
Yep.
This demonstrates the speed of which you hit the tree.
Brain damage, bleeding on the brain, coma.
Okay. And how long were you in a coma for?
Well, I was in and out, so I'm not sure. It wasn't that long. Okay. It was days, but it was in and out a little bit. So it was 8 days. I don't remember. My memory of that time is relatively fuzzy.
Yeah, of course.
It was about a week before I've got any memories of that time.
Okay.
Like, I can remember being in the race. I don't remember the crash. I don't remember the week after the crash. I can vaguely remember being in hospital and my wife telling me that I've been in a terrible accident. And a few other things that happened in that hospital as I came back to full consciousness. But yeah, that's about it.
Okay, and the recovery period, obviously there's stages of recovery, isn't it? It's not like, you know, I'm 100% on day 68 or whatever. It's there's stages of recovery with a brain incident. So how long did that take, more or less, would you say?
It took about 8 months, 7-8 months for full recovery, full mental function.
Okay.
But the first 4 months was absolutely horrendous. I mean, the first 4 months was like a horror movie. I mean, I've never been a person that's taken drugs. I don't say that to judge anybody. It's never been my thing, hallucinogenic drugs. But I've got friends who have. And the first 4 months, the only way I can describe it is it's exactly like what, for me, it varies for different people with different brain injuries, exactly like being on a bad acid trip. Like a bad LSD trip. So like I was seeing things, I was imagining things. I would swing from being insanely paranoid to insanely happy to insanely angry and aggressive. I had the memory of a goldfish. I wouldn't sleep for days. It was truly monstrous the first 4 months. And I'm astonished my wife, I said, put up with me for that long. But she did. And he came out the other side.
And so, you know, when you talk about this, whenever I talk about trauma or stuff on podcasts, I'm always like in coaching mode. So I don't give empathy or any of that stuff. If I need to, I will, but I'm not going to. You don't need it. It doesn't help you. But it sounds really cold, doesn't it? But anyway, so for the people listening, what's the sort of biggest learnings that you got from that incident? So the reason I ask this is, as we go through life, we have trigger points. And I would hope that for the people listening, they don't have to go through trauma in order to learn the trigger points. We can ask the people who've already gone through that trauma. So what was the biggest learnings for you from this accident, would you say?
Okay, so one person, one-on-one, wealth one. So the wealth one was simple. I got obsessed with investing in assets. And I recognized a bad habit of myself was to spend almost all of what I made. And now in the last few years, my income has increased exponentially, but my net worth has increased by more so. And again, I don't say that to boast. I'm saying that because I'm obsessive now every single month doing my personal balance sheet, calculating my net worth. And if I've ever got any spare cash, I mean, Dan, if you looked in my bank accounts, like you'd be astonished that there's almost never any cash there. Because it's always invested, because basically I'm conditioning myself because I've got a bad habit of, I remember like I lent money to a company one time, and when I got it back, when they finished repaying the loan, like it was like they were paying interest only in a lump sum at the end. I ended up with, I think it was £80,000 in capital. And they, I hadn't figured out, they paid it back a bit earlier than I expected, and they hadn't figured out where I was going to invest it instead. And stupidly, I left it in a bank account, a current account.
Yeah.
And then about a week or two later, by the time I'd figured out where I was going to invest that money, because I did need to, I wanted to invest it elsewhere, obviously.
Yeah.
It magically shrunk to £72,000.
Funny how that happens, isn't it? Well, where did that £8,000 go, I wonder?
Dan, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, and whilst you know, I have a very nice lifestyle, I wouldn't say I'm an aggressive spender anymore. But I just subconsciously, I found myself, I must have made decisions, book a slightly nicer holiday, for example, or get a slightly bigger, you know, new television, go out shopping or go out to dinner with friends and treat them all to dinner. All right, fine.
So many distractions.
Well, exactly. And there's nothing wrong with doing those things. But for crying out loud, do it consciously.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because you check your financial statement once a month. I've got cash flow forecasts for the next 12 months for my property and my business coaching business. But I look at my bank account every single day. I know what's coming in today and going out today and tomorrow.
Yep.
I can see the cash flow every single day, and I can see how that's tracked through graphs, and it's got peaks and troughs like everybody. And it's like, I am really anally retentive about looking up. It goes everywhere. It's on my laptop, it's on the plane, every single day. It's open now as we speak. It's there. And I am so anally retentive because I've been the same where you've got 50, 60 grand in the bank and then poof, it's down 5 grand and it's like, I don't know where that's gone.
It's frightening. And by the way, I just to support you, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I check my bank account. Again, I've got cash flow forecasts going out and I'm checking bank accounts every day. The business cash flow, to be honest, I'm looking at weekly, but the bank accounts I'm checking every single day. And if something goes out one of the accounts that I don't know about, an email's been sent to the relative employee at that company asking where the money's gone and what it's been spent on. But if you go, you spent some of that money. Okay, that's 8 grand. Yes, but if you look at 8 grand on the compounded rate of return you're getting on your portfolio, oh my word. The amount that that's actually just cost you is insane.
Do you know, £75 a month at 10% interest, and there are investments like wind farms, you get 10%. Over a 20-year period, I forget, it's either £30,000 or £54,000.
I can believe it.
70 quid a month. Okay, so you've got wealth, I get that, and we spoke about that earlier, awesome. And obviously being very aware of what your expenditure is like now is really, really important. What else did you get from your accident that were really valid learnings?
Well, this will sound cliche, and all I can say is this has been tremendously impactful for me. And just because you may have heard it before, or you may feel that you live it, I want you to listen to this and really recommit to it. Yeah. And that is the importance of family and the importance of relationships.
Yeah.
I'm not naturally the most social. I'm not, whilst I'd like to say, oh yeah, I'm a good father. I spend time with my kids, etc. I'm a good husband, etc. And I'd like to think that's true. It reiterates to me the importance of nurturing those relationships. Again, like I'm not naturally the warmest person in the world. So like friendships, I endeavor now to, when we go on a holiday, a lot of the times when we go away with friends or with family members. Not so you have to live in each other's pocket, but so you can build a much deeper connection. Because really at the end of the day, money will come and go. There'll be peaks and troughs. There'll be successes and there'll be failures. And you can have lots of cool things. You can have your Ferraris and you can have your whatever. But really, at the end of the day, it's how much joy and laughter and fun you're getting out of and how much value you're contributing to the people in your life.
And I've got one final question. It's a weird question, I think. But are you glad it happened?
In a word, yes. I remember literally for the first year or so, I was saying this is the most horrendous thing ever and I can't possibly ever imagine ever being grateful for this. And then I remember the day, I can't remember how long after it was. It wasn't that long, but a year or two after, when I looked around at my life and I went, you know what? That was one of the best things that could have happened in my entire life.
It's funny, isn't it? How something as horrific as that accident and then with the benefit of hindsight. And what I say to clients about stuff like this is you've not finished the lesson yet. You having that accident was the beginning of the lesson. And then you hitting that realization of going, actually, do you know what? If that hadn't have happened, I would have been on the same path. And whilst you were comfortable on that path, you'd not got all these, well, the wealth in terms of long-term wealth and the improvement, and because we can all improve family relationships, can't we? But the improvement that you've got because of that accident. I just find it really interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's why things like this podcast are phenomenal, Dan. It gives people a chance to hopefully learn. And if I have in any way been able to add some value that can benefit somebody, then this call's been worthwhile.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, thank you very much, Dan. I really appreciate your time. We've probably overran quite considerably in your already busy day. I really appreciate it. If people want to contact Dan, it's danbradbury.com. I'll put links on my website so that people can just click on them and take you straight through. Dan, personally, I've loved having you as a client, and you're going to be a client for a long time, I hope, and we're going to help you buy a lot of property. But on a personal note, I love interviewing you today, and I've got a page full of notes. Just on a personal note, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, guys, and look forward to connecting again with you soon.
That's awesome, Dan. Take care.
Bye-bye.
The Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.